physics of cosmic bubble collisions. Hiranya has already described some possible evidence that there's something like this in the CMB, and I think that would be very exciting. And what I'll try to do is review where the theory behind that comes from, and I won't have time to go into detail on many aspects, but I'll try to give an overview. So this talk will be based on lots of previous work by myself, by many other people. So there's some of it. So I'll start with something that we've heard several times now already today, which is that it looks like in the string landscape there are a large number... It looks like there are a large number of metastable phases with positive vacuum energy. And in classical physics, if the universe is populated by a phase like that, it will inflate. It will undergo eternal inflation. Quantum mechanically, there are phase transitions, first-order phase transitions, in which regions of the universe can decay to other phases. And as we've heard several times now, if the decay rate, if the total decay rate for any such transition is less than 1 in units of the false vacuum Hubble constant, then it seems that false vacuum eternal inflation will take place in that phase. What's maybe a little bit surprising is that when these transitions occur, inside each bubble that appears is actually a homogeneous, isotropic, and infinite volume open FRW cosmology. And so if this model is a correct description of reality, then presumably we're inside one such bubble. However, that homogeneity and isotropy will eventually be broken because it's guaranteed that there will eventually be collisions with other bubbles that form in the false vacuum near the one that that you find yourself in. So here's a simulation. This represents a slice of the universe at late times. These purple regions are bubbles that formed. The larger they are, the further back in the past they formed. And if you continue to iterate this, smaller and smaller bubbles will appear. And each one of these clusters will grow without bound to contain an infinite number of bubbles and bubble collisions. So there are a number of questions that we should ask. I'll try to answer some of these in this talk. If we're interested in observing and testing this model, then we should ask how likely we are to be able to observe these collisions, either the collisions or the fact that we're in one of these bubbles in the first place. And there are a couple of things that might make you worry that that's going to be hard. One of them is that, generally speaking, the rate at which these decays occur is exponentially small in the action for some instanton. So it can be a very, it can be a rare event for bubbles to form. So if it's a rare event for bubbles to form, you would expect it's might be difficult to see collisions because they're unlikely. And another thing that could worry you is slow roll inflation. If there's a period of slow roll inflation in inside our bubble, it tends to inflate away any interesting effects that come from collisions. And I'll come back to that in a little bit. But if we could observe them, we might want to know what can we learn about them, what can we learn about very high energy physics from observing these bubbles, and in particular, can we use them as a test of string theory? And more specifically, what would we see? What are the effects on cosmology from these collisions? And are there any indications in the current data that something like that is there? So as I mentioned, if this picture is correct, then we're inside a bubble surrounded by some parent false vacuum, which is very, very rapidly inflating. It turns out that this picture has some very deep and profound implications for how we view cosmology in general, apart from specifically what the signatures are and whether or not we can see collisions. There's some very dramatic implications for cosmology for the way we usually think about the Big Bang. So, for example, people usually say that there's a curvature singularity in our past, because if you go back into the past, the universe was contracting, and then there are singularity theorems that tell you that once the universe is contracting, absent some violation of an energy condition, it will form a curvature singularity. Since gravity is attractive, it gets stronger and stronger. But it turns out that that's not the case if we're inside one of these bubbles, at least in the sense that the apparent curvature singularity that's 13.7 giga-years in our past, is not actually a curvature singularity. It's just the origin of polar coordinates, in a sense. It's a coordinate singularity. And the singularity theorems are evaded in this model because they require, first of all, energy conditions. Some of them require dominant energy condition that isn't satisfied by potential energy in a scalar. And some of them require genericity assumptions, which are not satisfied in this model. And in general, you wouldn't expect them to be satisfied when you're going back in time. So that's one thing that's important to remember. There's a big difference between going back in time and going forward in time. Going back in time, you don't expect necessarily that things will be generic because the entropy can be decreasing. And so in this class of models, we could potentially observe events that took place before the Big Bang, and that has a definite meaning here, and in fact that took place outside the universe, at least outside the part of the universe that's described by Friedman, Robertson, Walker cosmology. So here's a space-time diagram of a bubble. What it's supposed to show you is how it's possible to have an infinite universe inside a bubble that appeared with finite size. The way that works is these red lines are what might be the most natural space-time slicing in which to think of this event. So the bottom horizontal line, there's nothing, then a bubble appears and it expands. That's this sort of dark blue V is the bubble expanding. And if you take these red slices across, these horizontal slices across, you see that the size of the bubble is growing, it's expanding. But if instead you choose the coordinate system that's drawn in blue here, then slices of constant time inside that V, they all fit inside the bubble. And those are the slices which have homogeneity and isotropy. So that's an open universe. Those slices have negative spatial curvature. And they fit inside this bubble after it appears. The Big Bang is the null line, the 45-degree blue V. That's T equals zero, the Big Bang. And if you look at this metric, and you know, which isn't written here, that A of T goes like T when T is small, you'll be able to see quite easily that there's no curvature singularity at T equals zero. There's just a time when the spatial curvature, the radius of curvature goes to zero, but nevertheless it's not a curvature singularity. Now, these bubbles have certain generic features which arise primarily from the fact that the instanton that mediates this transition, so the solution to the Euclidean equations of motion that controls the appearance of these bubbles, has rotation invariance in Euclidean space. In other words, in a 3 plus 1 dimensional theory at least, it has an SO4 invariance. And it's that SO4 invariance which translates into this homogeneity and isotropy. So it turns into an SO3,1. That's the symmetry group of an open FRW cosmology. Negative spatial curvature, infinite volume. Now, I should say that it's not guaranteed that, I mean, even if this model is correct and we live in one of these bubbles, it's not guaranteed that the decay which created the bubble we're in had that invariance. There are other possibilities. So one that's been studied recently is tunneling from a lower dimensional parent vacuum, a 2 plus 1 dimensional vacuum, where there's a third spatial dimension that's compact, and in the tunneling it decompactifies. That solution has different symmetry. Another possibility is a classical transition, where the collision between two bubbles forms a new region in between. So those are some other possibilities. I'll focus, however, on solutions with this SO4 invariance. So one problem that Ben Freivogel mentioned earlier today that actually isn't necessarily a problem but could have been is that when these bubbles appear, they tend to be empty and, as I said, very close to homogeneous and isotropic. There are, of course, small fluctuations around that. But because they have negative curvature, small fluctuations aren't good enough to form structure. Negative curvature is like faster than escape velocity expansion. And if you have an overdensity, it has to be a big enough overdensity to collapse and form structure later because of the negative curvature. And when these bubbles form, they have very large negative curvature and typically small fluctuations. So therefore, you'd have an empty universe problem. The bubble will expand, but there'll be nothing inside it, no galaxies, no structure. So you need some period of slow roll inflation in order to solve the curvature problem and generate perturbations. And that has to take place inside the bubble after it forms. So I'm not talking about the inflation in the false vacuum, a la old inflation. I'm talking about inflation after the bubble forms. So this potential that's drawn here is an example of one that would give rise to that. The dashed line is tunneling. After the tunneling, the field rolls down onto that plateau, and it doesn't overshoot, as Ben explained. Friction slows it down. And so, in fact, slow roll inflation would take place if the potential looked like that. And that model is consistent with what we know. One thing I should say, though, you need roughly 60. That number depends a little bit on things like the reheating temperature and so on. But you need roughly 60 E folds of inflation in order to explain the observations that we make today. But if you had many more E-folds than that for some reason, the universe that would result would be indistinguishable from a flat universe, because if you inflate for long enough, you get rid of all traces of the curvature and everything else that was there before the beginning of inflation. And in fact, this illustrates what's probably the most significant problem in any attempt to test very high energy physics with cosmology, namely inflation. It's a great theory, it does many things for us, but it also hides the remnants of what came either before the Big Bang or occurred at around the Big Bang that we might want to see. Of course, we could also look for effects that are generated during inflation or after inflation. Those can also come from high energy physics. But the other thing is that the other possibility is that if inflation didn't last much more than the number of E-folds necessary to solve the flatness problem, and there are some reasons to think that that might be true, then we do have a chance of seeing effects which were there before it started. So just to summarize, before moving on to the effects of bubble collisions, if we're inside a bubble that formed from an SO4 invariant instanton, then there are certain characteristic features that we can look for. The bubble, as I said, has negative spatial curvature. And if we could measure the curvature, it seems, given current experimental constraints, we're probably not going to be able to see this. But if we could see large enough scales, we would see that there's a characteristic there's some characteristic features of the power spectrum on large scales. On scales of order, the curvature radius, the power spectrum of density perturbations is affected. One thing that it's worth pointing out is that if we measure a megatotal greater than 1, in other words, if the curvature turns out to be positive, this model is ruled out. And, well, I wouldn't say that that falsifies string theory. That's too strong. It certainly would be a major challenge to the way we view the string theory landscape and cosmology to account for positive curvature. So I think we can say that the string theory landscape is falsifiable and predictive. There's an asterisk there, which just says, in case you can't read it, that too much inflation makes it really hard to confirm many of these predictions because it wipes away what was there before. Okay, so I mentioned that collisions... what time did I start, actually? 5:13, okay. So I mentioned that collisions are guaranteed to happen, and the reason for that is simply that the space around the bubble, outside of it, is always in the false vacuum. And the false vacuum we know is unstable since it produced the bubble we're in. Therefore, it is able to decay. And if it decays, at least if a decay occurs close enough to the wall of our bubble, it will collide with our bubble. And since that has a finite probability per unit time, it keeps happening. And so it produces infinitely large clusters of bubbles with interesting statistics. So one question is how many such bubbles we expect to be in our past light cone today. In other words, how many do we have a chance of seeing? If they're not in our past light cone today, then obviously we won't be able to see them. And of the ones that are in our past light cone, how many of them could be observable? So this question has been studied in the past by a number of people. What one does crudely is just considers our past light cone today. That has some amount of four volume inside the false vacuum. The false vacuum has a decay rate. Multiply the decay rate by the 4 volume, and you get the expected number of bubble nucleations. However, this is a more subtle problem than that makes it sound. For one thing, there are some very large dimensionless parameters which come in. One of them is the fact that we know that the energy scale today and also the energy scale during slow roll inflation was much lower than the Planck scale or the string scale. And therefore, if the false vacuum had an energy density which was of order the fundamental scale, there's a very big dimensionless ratio, namely the Hubble constant today or the Hubble constant during inflation divided by the false vacuum energy density. And in fact, that dimensionless ratio does come in. I'll try to explain how and why. There's another subtlety which arises due to the fact that because the false vacuum is a false vacuum and is unstable, it can't really have existed for an infinite amount of time without decaying. And so what one typically does is impose that at some early time the state was, the field, for example, if there's a single field, was in its false vacuum, and then evolves from there. But the imposition of that initial condition breaks de Sitter invariance because you have to do that on some spatial slice at a given time. And it turns out that the memory of that initial condition doesn't necessarily go away. And this was called the persistence of memory. And it leads to an anisotropy. So if we happen to be at rest in the frame in which that initial condition was imposed, then it's isotropic. But if we don't happen to be at rest, and there's no reason why we would be, that's an anisotropic initial condition. And so it leads to an anisotropy in the distribution of bubble collisions. This was noticed by Garriga, Guth, and Vilenkin. However, it turns out that taking into account the cosmology inside our bubble, taking into account the fact that the energy density today and the energy density during inflation was much smaller than the one in the false vacuum, that anisotropy is actually very small. And in fact, if one computes, so the distribution of bubble collisions is, to a very good approximation, isotropic on our sky. And if one computes what the total number of such collisions should be, so how many collisions are there in our past light cone today, the answer looks like this. It's the decay rate per unit time per unit volume, that's that capital gamma, times a ratio, or depending on how you write it, a product, that involves the energy density during inflation, that's V sub I, so that 1 over V sub I, you could also write as R sub I, that's the length scale during inflation, the Hubble length during inflation squared, times some factors of the false vacuum, Hubble constant. The reason there's this Hubble length during inflation squared factor is that most of these collisions, and perhaps this is the best answer to the question that was asked earlier about how big the bubbles are when they collide, most of the collisions take place during inflation or right at the beginning of inflation, when in some sense our bubble has a size set by the Hubble length during inflation, and therefore a surface area, which is Hubble length during inflation squared. So it has a big surface area in units of the false vacuum Hubble length. And so because it has a large surface area, there's a lot of opportunity for collisions to take place. So the total number of collisions is enhanced by this factor of the Hubble length during inflation squared. So this goes some way towards addressing this worry that because gamma is very small, because the decay rate is very small, collisions might be very rare. Gamma is probably quite small, but there's a large dimensionless factor multiplying it. So if VF is of order the Planck scale or the string scale, then the ratio of VF over VI is at least 10 to the 10 or so. The scale of inflation couldn't have been higher than that, given that we haven't observed tensor modes. Now, of those collisions that have occurred, some of them are going to be hard to detect. For example, collisions that occurred very early, at the very beginning of inflation, have a light cone which eats up all of the part of the universe we can see. And those are probably hard to detect, although it might be possible. So to be conservative, we could look only at the collisions which have a light cone, which have affected a part of the universe that cuts the part of the last scattering surface that we could see in the cosmic microwave background into two pieces. In other words, the type of collision that doesn't eat up the whole part of the universe we can see, but cuts it into two sections. If you remember that inflation solves the curvature problem just by expanding it so much that curvature is hard to see, there's a convenient way to parameterize that. Omega k is, in some sense, the energy density in curvature. It tells you how big the curvature is compared to, for example, matter today. And what inflation does is it makes omega k very small, exponentially small. So at the end of inflation, omega k is extremely small, but it grows between the end of inflation and now. In any case, inflation has the effect of only allowing us to see a small part of the universe, if you want, of the last scattering surface. So because we can only see a small part of the last scattering surface if omega k is small, then requiring that the bubble collision affect, like cut that region in half, is going to multiply the number of such collisions by that factor. In other words, instead of looking at the entire last scattering surface, we're just looking at a fraction of square root omega k of it. So anyway, in the end, the number of collisions looks like this. I think Hiranya had this formula also in her talk. So this is not necessarily very small. Gamma is probably small. Omega k, observationally, is less than about 0.1 or so. But this factor of h false over h inflation squared can be quite large. So one interesting fact, which isn't directly relevant for cosmological observations today, is that the late time distribution of these collisions, I mentioned there are these clusters, the statistics of these clusters turns out to be conformally invariant. In fact, it's a fractal, which is scale invariant, rotation invariant, translation invariant, and invariant under special conformal transformations. And so there's perhaps some connection to a de Sitter conformal field theory correspondence. In any case, there's some interesting physics to be understood regarding the distribution of these bubble collisions at late time. And there again is this picture. So it turns out that according to Mandelbrot in his book, this particular distribution approximates that of craters on the moon for some reason. So I called it crater percolation. Okay, but now coming back to cosmological signatures of these collisions, it's convenient to study the collision between just two bubbles, at least to begin with, and then to take into account collisions between many bubbles, so long as the collision occurs, so long as the effects overlap at a time when they're sufficiently weak, one can use linear perturbation theory, and so the effects just superpose. If a three-bubble collision took place at the time when the effects are very strong, this would not be a good approximation. But that's actually not particularly likely, given that this gamma is small and there are a large number of collisions only because there's a large surface area. So in any case, one can study the collision between two bubbles. And it turns out that, maybe surprisingly, this is possible to do. It's possible to find exact solutions to Einstein's equations that describe this. There are some approximations made. One of them is that the bubbles are dominated by vacuum energy and the false vacuum is dominated by vacuum energy. And although it's actually not necessary, it's convenient to assume that any other energy density in the problem is confined into thin walls. And under that set of assumptions, you can find an exact solution. That's surprising because although these bubbles have spherical symmetry, the collision of two spherically symmetric objects in general relativity is generally very hard to study. Like the collision between two black holes is impossible to study analytically, and even numerically it's very hard. But bubbles have more symmetry than black holes do. And so in fact, one can find these nice analytic solutions. And one of the things that you discover is that if the two bubbles that collide correspond to different phases, then there's a domain wall between them. And that domain wall has a pressure on it. Therefore, it accelerates. And it can either accelerate, if we're in one of these bubbles, towards us. If we're an inertial observer, it can accelerate towards us, or it can accelerate away from us. And one can deduce under what conditions it accelerates away from us. If it accelerates towards us, it kills us before we have a chance to notice it, because very rapidly it's moving at the speed of light. So that's not interesting. Hopefully it accelerates away from us. What would we see if we're struck by another bubble and the domain wall that separates us from it accelerates away from us? Well, if you look at this space-time diagram drawn here, the light cone of the collision is that dashed line there on the right. So if we live in the part of the space-time before that dashed line, to the past of that dashed line, there's nothing to be seen. The collision is in our causal future. And however, if we live in the part of the space-time that's to the future of that dashed line, then we have at least some chance of observing the bubble collision. And it turns out that the most easily observable effect is not in direct energy or direct radiation that's released into our bubble from the collision. It's rather in its effect on the inflaton. So remember, there has to be slow roll inflation inside our bubble. And perturbations to the inflaton are very sensitive in the sense that we can observe them very easily, because since the inflaton was the dominant energy density in the universe, even small fluctuations in the inflaton field are observable today. So the easiest way to see this is to look for its effect on the inflaton. And exactly what that effect is certainly model dependent. It depends on what was in the other bubble that collided with us, and it depends on the inflation model and so on. But it turns out that the signal in the end is actually not very model dependent. And the reason is because of this large degree of symmetry that I've mentioned, and also because of slow roll inflation itself, which tends to inflate away everything. It exponentially reduces everything except a leading effect. So in the end, one can parameterize the effect with just four parameters, which are the location of the center of the bubble, the angular radius of the affected region, so this affects a disk on the CMB with some angular radius, and the magnitude of the effect, the magnitude of the temperature anomaly at the center. So maybe I won't go through this in detail, but this is justifying this statement that one can parameterize the effect in terms of these four parameters. Essentially, what you do is, because of the symmetry, everything is symmetric under an SO2,1. Basically, the collision preserves a group of isometries, which is like the group of isometries of a plane. It's actually of a hyperboloid. But in any case, you can imagine that the universe is cut in half by a plane which sweeps across it at the speed of light. And all the perturbations have this planar symmetry. And that's enough to allow you to solve analytically for the evolution of inflaton perturbations. So you can understand in quite a lot of detail exactly how inflaton perturbations evolve, because it's a 1+1 dimensional problem. And you can write down a general solution. This is much like the solution for the free field wave equation in 1+1 dimensions, except modified because it's during inflation, so there's a de Sitter expansion. In any case, one can find these solutions. And then to make it as general as possible, you can imagine that the perturbation was just some general power series, so we don't have to assume anything about it other than that it's small. So there was just some power series perturbation that's confined behind the light cone of the collision, and then see how it evolves. And when you do this, what you find is that at least close to the edge of the affected region, the inflaton perturbation becomes linear. So there's no effect outside the light cone of the affected region. And inside the affected region, there's a linear growth, if you want, in the inflaton, in delta phi, in the perturbation to the inflaton. If we know what the perturbation in the inflaton field is, we can convert it into a perturbation in the CMB temperature, and also in things like large-scale structure and so forth. That's all straightforward. We can just use the standard machinery of cosmological perturbation theory to do that. So what one does is compute the perturbation in the co-moving curvature zeta, or in the Newtonian potential. And then through the Sachs-Wolfe effect, that affects the CMB temperature today. Here's what one finds. So I mentioned before, there's no effects outside the light cone of this collision. There's a linear effect inside. If you just translate that into a temperature at this level, and I'll make this slightly more precise in the next slide, but at this level, that red circle is the Earth's last scattering, is the projection of the Earth's light cone onto the last scattering surface. So that's our CMB sky. And you can see that on the right side of this picture, there's no effect. On the left side, there's an effect which grows like cosine of theta, because it's linear in x, and x is proportional to cosine theta. So there's a disk inside of which there's a temperature anomaly proportional to cosine theta, and it has an angular radius, which I've denoted theta c. So here are some plots of it. These are actually more accurate than the approximation on the previous slide. These are taking into account various other effects. But roughly speaking, these plots are... this is the temperature anomaly as a function of angular radius from the center of the disk. And roughly speaking, they look like cosine theta out to some edge and then zero beyond it. The effect can either be to make a hot spot or a cold spot, depending on how the collision affects the inflaton. Now, what I just showed you is a bit of a, not the plots I just showed you, but the slide before that was a bit of a cartoon, because that's the effect on the Newtonian potential at the end of inflation. But one has to take into account the evolution of the universe between the end of inflation, between reheating and last scattering, decoupling. It's the physics in between those two times that's responsible for the peaks in the CMB, because there are acoustic waves in the plasma that dominates the universe after reheating. And in any case, the result of that is to spread out that edge that I showed you before into a more smooth band. Now, that doesn't have much effect on temperature. These plots actually take that into account, so it doesn't have much effect on the temperature anomaly. But there's another signature in the CMB. One of the things we can measure in the CMB is the temperature as a function of angle on the sky, but another thing is polarization of CMB photons. CMB photons have linear polarization due to Thompson scattering, so last scattering is not really last scattering. They propagate from then until now and occasionally scatter off electrons, and that produces polarization, just like reflections generally produce polarized light. So this is a plot that shows you what the polarization pattern looks like for this bubble collision signature. It can either be radial or tangential, depending on whether it's a hot or a cold spot, cold or hot spot. And if you're interested in what exactly is the effect on polarization in more detail, then these are some plots of the magnitude of the polarization as a function of, again, angular radius going out from the center of the spot towards the edge. And what you find is there's this funny structure, this double peak in the degree of polarization. So on this plot, the degree of polarization is the length of the line. On this plot, it's the y-axis. You can see that there's this double peak in polarization, which is a very distinctive signature, one can predict the relative heights of these two peaks and their angular separation as a function of the angular radius of the disk. And this all follows from very, very simple geometry. It also comes out of numerical analysis, but it follows from some very simple geometry. How much time is left? Okay. Well, I'll wrap up in a minute or two. So if there's a characteristic, I mean, if we observe a feature in the temperature map that looks like it might be a bubble collision, the next thing to do is to measure polarization in the same region and see whether it conforms to this prediction. I should say that when the disk is sufficiently small, less than about 10 degrees, the double peak actually disappears for reasons that are quite easy to explain, but would take me about maybe 3 or 4 minutes. So this double peak structure is only visible for disks that are larger than about 10 degrees. Now, I think Jim asked about other signatures of these things. There certainly are other signatures. Basically, you've divided the universe into two pieces. There's the part that's affected and the part that isn't affected, at least at the time of early times. And as a result, there is actually a sheet of matter at the edge of this light cone. It moves at more or less the speed of light until matter domination, at which point it stops. So somewhere out there would be a sheet of overdensity. However, it's not a very large overdensity. It's not particularly easy to see looking directly in galaxies, for example, but it might be possible under some circumstances. It also does have a lensing effect. It acts like a giant magnifying glass. So it's not that easy to see because it doesn't distort the shapes of anything. It's a planar sheet, roughly. So there's something called mass sheet degeneracy in the lensing literature, which is a problem that if you have a planar sheet of matter, it just magnifies everything behind it. It doesn't change the shape. But some lensing surveys look for that. So in principle, it's possible to see. other cosmological signatures, things like 21-centimeter data, which in principle can be much more precise than even the CMB, would be able to probe this in detail. In any case, there are a whole set of associated signals. They all have the same symmetry. They're all centered on the same point. And so if the effect on the CMB is strong enough to see, the next thing to do would be to investigate these in more detail and see. okay. Hiranya already mentioned this, that there are some features on the CMB sky which are consistent with bubble collisions. I should just make two comments about that. One is, I don't know how to get a discontinuity at the edge in the temperature map, so this parameter that she called Z critical, for me is zero, and I don't know how to make it not zero. And the other is that small disks are rather unlikely. They're less likely than larger ones. So if, in fact, all or any of those disks is, in fact, due to a bubble collision, there should be larger in angular radius collisions as well. Okay, so let me just conclude. First of all, the take-home message, we can test false vacuum eternal inflation and things as exotic as the string theory landscape using cosmological observables. These bubbles, when they form, are empty and negatively curved. Therefore, you need slow roll inflation, but too much slow roll inflation is bad in the sense that it makes it hard to see what came before. You might have expected that these collisions would be very rare if nucleation events are rare, but that's not necessarily the case because there are other parameters that we know are large, multiplying the expected number. The effect on the universe is to divide it into two pieces, and the sheet that divides it is actually hyperbolic, but it's approximately planar since curvature is small. The expected distribution of sizes is flat in d cosine theta, so sine theta d theta. That's the angular size of the affected disk in the temperature map. Effect on temperature is smooth. I don't think it has this discontinuity at the edge. It's approximately the form written there. However, there can be fairly sharp features in E-mode polarization, and there are other large-scale cosmological observables that could corroborate that. So I'll end there. Thank you.
If you look inside a bubble at angular scales that are much smaller than the size of the bubble, do you expect to see a modulation of the power of the average delta T over T on small scales inside versus outside?
Probably not, because given that we haven't seen these yet, at least not with more than 1.6 sigma of confidence or so, they have to be quite weak. The effect has to be quite weak, and therefore it's linear. So at some second-order level, there would be such modulations, but they're going to be very difficult to detect.
I guess this is something people always ask, so I'll just ask it. But intuitively, I could imagine that you could have isocurvature perturbations or non-Gaussianities, you know, especially like in a multi-field picture. You could imagine mm-hmm. somehow you get kicked in some mm-hmm. direction, and that would induce that. So mm-hmm. what's the answer?
Well, for non-Gaussianities, in a sense, this is a non-Gaussianity. It's an extremely unlikely thing to be produced by Gaussian fluctuations. But it's better not to think of it in those terms. It's better to think of it as something localized in you know, angle space, and it's a particular feature that we can look for. But it is a non-Gaussianity in that sense. Multi-field models have not been investigated, as far as I know, and it would be interesting, actually, to see what happens. The instanton produces, it sort of drops you in at rest somewhere on the potential, and I think that's true also in multi-field models. But then once the field starts to roll, it could follow some, I mean, you know, there could be some valley which turns or whatever, and in that case you can have interesting features where the inflaton kind of rolls up one side and then oscillates down. So that can also happen. But again, I mean, the effects have to be fairly weak since we haven't observed them, and so certainly one can use linear perturbation theory. So it can't be sort of too exotic.
And one of them was the location of the bubble. What did you mean by that?
I just mean that on the sky, there's a center. I have no idea where. Oh, there it is. On the sky, there's a center to the disk. So there's a particular direction, which is the center of the affected disk on the CMB sky. And what that direction is the bubble that hit us is coming from that direction. That's where the collision took place.
Have you studied the nonlinear effects of the bubbles colliding with each other?
For example, which effects?
So these two bubbles collide. Imagine they collide with a very large gamma factor.
Yes.
So you form some sheet, as you say, a sheet of energy, concentrated mm-hmm. energy density. Mm-hmm. But that sheet could fragment. Have you studied that? Could just form a whole lot of black holes.
So let's see. It's true that. So right after the collision, things can be quite nonlinear. Back reaction can be very important. That has not been studied in great detail. What's basically been studied is the effect on the inflaton, which one can do that sometime after the collision, because at some point, since inflation has to begin in that region, the effect has to be weak. And rather than assuming anything about the model, you can just put in an arbitrary perturbation. So you can just expand the perturbation in a power series with arbitrary coefficients, and then evolve it through slow roll inflation and see what the effect is later. And what the effect is later is this linear
that's
term.
Sort of assuming the effect is weak.
Right, but if the effect isn't weak, then we would know it already. So basically it's self-consistency. We either...
So the gamma factor of the collision has to be really small?
No. No, the gamma factor can be pretty large. But it doesn't necessarily produce lots of black holes or lots of structure. This is something that happens in the very early universe before slow roll inflation even began. By the end of inflation, the energy density in that wall is quite low, actually, because it's redshifted by a factor of e to the minus 2n or so.
It wouldn't have just stopped the inflation in the region where it happened?
For a while, yes. But as the universe continues to expand, the energy density decreases, and eventually inflation will begin. And it's at that point that one can put this in as an arbitrary perturbation and then see how it evolves. Still, it would be pretty interesting to do numerical simulations, which I think is what you'd have to do, and see, you know, really what can happen. Some of them have been done.
So at the level of field theory, you trust that the collision is a local event. I think people do have a good idea of what could happen under the assumption that it really is SO2-1 symmetric without gravity, but it's a local field theory.
No, I'm asking about gravity.
But he's asking about back
reaction. The energy scales get to Planckian energy scales. I don't think